Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 88 of The Great Divide, the Big Country Podcast. This is Tom. Svein is not here with me right now, but he's going to be joining me presently. And this is going to be a little bit different of an episode than what we've done in the last, I don't know, couple years. Number one, it's an episode that's under 90 minutes long, which is unbelievable. And yes, it is true. You'll see, it's under 90 minutes. Number two, this episode is going to feature two special guests, and this is probably going to be the first of these kinds of episodes. We've got probably maybe two more left to do, but the people that are going to be on the show today are actually pledgers. They are pledgers to the WKW Men of Steel crowdfunding campaign that we held not too long ago, so that we, WKW, that's Bruce Watson, Jamie Watson, and myself, Tom Kercheval, could release our new album, Men of Steel, on CD. So thanks so much to all you guys who participated in that and who have bought it since, which has been awesome. But there was a tier on that crowdfunding campaign where people could contribute a certain amount, and that would get them an appearance on the podcast. So we're going to do the first two of those today, and we've got four more to go after these two. But these are some really fun guests to talk to. These are just regular Big Country fans like all of us, and they've got some interesting stories to tell about their own unique Big Country experiences. So their names are Stuart Arnott and Tom Stieber. You may recognize some of these names, you may not, but you will know them after this show. So let's start out with Stuart Arnott, shall we? Here we go. Okay, everyone. So we are now joined by Stuart Arnott. He is a guy who pledged in the WKW campaign to be on the podcast, and we are more than happy to welcome him from London. And Stuart, welcome to The Great Divide.
Thank you very much.
It's awesome to have you. And as I mentioned to you offline, thank you so much for your contribution to WKW. And Stuart has some great things to talk about here that you know, we would love to have him on the show no matter what he did with the pledge. So this is going to be fun. And as always, Svein from Norway is here with me. Hello, Svein.
Hello. I'm going to take a back seat here.
Yes, exactly.
But let's talk with our guest.
Yeah. So, Stuart, tell us a little bit about your first introduction to Big Country. And you saw them back in the first tour. So when was the first time you actually heard them and became aware of them?
Probably about 6 months before I saw them live. So probably around the time that Fields of Fire first came out. So I kind of missed Harvest Home being released. But I used to work shifts back in those days. I'm still in technology now, but in those days you used to have big old computer rooms. And we used to have the radio on after 5 o'clock when the business went home, and we would have the radio cranked up. And this song came on, which was Fields of Fire, and it absolutely blew me away. And from that particular moment, I was a massive Big Country fan. I was aware of what Stuart had done in the skids, but I only sort of heard bits and bobs of theirs, not really bought too many singles or albums of theirs up to that point, maybe a couple of singles, Working for the Yankee Dollar and Circus Games. But once I heard Fields of Fire, I didn't really connect Stuart as being in the skids at that time, so it came as a bit of a bolt out of the blue. But from that... from that particular moment, that was me hooked. I rushed out and bought Fields of Fire the next day and couldn't wait to see them tour, basically. And from where I was in London, fortunately, there's a couple of really nice venues near where I live. It was a Hammersmith Apollo that they did on Crossing the Fall tour. And the atmosphere walking into the place was just incredible. It was like I can only liken it to maybe some kind of sporting event, because the band, even before they came on, all the fans in the bars and in the foyers and what have you were singing In a Big Country and Fields of Fire, and it was just a huge atmosphere. And when you've got 3,500 people before the band even got on that were absolutely up for the gig, then you can imagine what the show was like after that. It was just absolutely phenomenal.
Oh, amazing. So they were singing the songs before the show even started.
Absolutely, yeah. So you've got, to get to the stage, it was an old movie theater that got converted into, for concerts. And, bands still play there now. Absolutely. And so you've got that big sort of foyer, quite a large bar area. So there must have been 1,500 people upstairs, maybe 2,000 downstairs, but I was upstairs. The atmosphere, I'll definitely have that as one of the top three gigs of all time for me to go and see. That was for sure. It was awesome.
That's incredible. That's incredible. So what was the, and you've kind of already answered this question in a sense, what with the accolades that you just gave it, but just if you could elaborate a little bit more even on what the experience of seeing them live like was versus, you hearing them on the radio, you hearing the song, the single. After you saw them live, I'm assuming that must have skyrocketed your fandom to another level.
Well, it did, yeah. I must admit, I'm a bit of an anorak when it comes to big country. And, I've opened up, like a record collection of theirs. I've got something like 400 records, just over 400 records of theirs that I've collected worldwide. I've been lucky enough to see the band maybe 50 or so times live over the years. I've not gone so much. Now Tony and Stuart are no longer around, but certainly I've seen them a couple of times without Tony and Stuart, but mostly obviously with the core lineup, really.
Right. Is there a particular tour that really stands out to you, even beyond that first show that you saw? But is there one tour that you saw that you thought, wow, they were absolutely on fire on this one especially?
So, yeah, I think, to be honest with you, live, they were phenomenal. I can't remember going to see them and ever coming away disappointed. That just never happened. And obviously, Stuart's health sort of fluctuated a little bit on some of the tours. Certainly from the final tour, I suppose, was probably the most poignant. Saw them at Shepherd's Bush, at Shepherd's Bush Hall there. And again, I couldn't believe that was going to be the final fling, because they were incredible. A criminally underrated album, in my opinion, was Driving to Damascus. I'm sure you've spoken before about how the charts over here in the UK, Rob Fragile thing of being a much higher placing than it ultimately got because of some marketing problems with their packaging.
Yes.
But other than that, I mean, they were such good form on the final fling tour. And I felt sure that maybe after another year or two, just taking a break or whatever, the boys would be back, because they certainly were at the peak of their game. There's no question about it. They'd grown as musicians, and musically they were just phenomenal.
Yeah, exactly. And we did speak, Svein, maybe just a couple minutes about Driving to Damascus on their show.
Well, I think the tally was 14 hours, 21 minutes.
Yeah, fair enough. You've probably beaten me, I would say.
We are long-winded, if nothing else. But yeah, you're right. I didn't see them on the Driving to Damascus tour, really. But I guess in a way I saw them. Well, in a way I did, because I saw them in Nashville in the United States before the album came out. Yeah,
that was the pre-Folds fiasco. So that was, the narrative is that the wind kind of went out of their sails after that. But that's why it's so interesting to hear you, Stuart, talk about what a phenomenal show you felt it was.
Yeah,
the wind hadn't gone out of their sails. They really were good.
But yours was the final fling too. So that was a couple of years after.
Yeah. I mean, there is no question about it. Musically, they were in an incredible place at the time. The whole band were just incredible. I saw Stuart in the Raphaels at Dingwalls.
Oh wow! With
Marcus Hummond a couple of years after that, and it was a very small gig, 250 people maybe. But again, you could see that Stuart wasn't. He didn't feel that he was 100% at that time. But I mean, again, even from probably not at the peak of his mental state, he certainly musically, they were absolutely on the ball, and the crowd were going nuts. Mm. They sort of finished with In a Big Country, like an acoustic version, a country version of In a Big Country.
Yeah.
And I kind of felt that the reaction that he got, that they both sort of stood there and you could see they were a little bit shocked with the reaction that they got from playing it. And Stuart said, I don't know what else we can play. We've played all the songs that we know. There's nothing else we can do. Do you want us to play something that we've already played? So, of course, the crowd went, yes. So they played a couple of songs that they played earlier in the set. Supernatural, which was obviously the lead song off of the album. And then they played In a Big Country again. And just the place just exploded.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. There's no doubt about it. He would have definitely have been blown away by the reaction that they got.
That's amazing. And you know, not to sidetrack the discussion too much, but when you think about it, it almost seems to me like Big Country has seen a resurgence over the years recently. Like their live shows are doing great, and it seems like the community online is bigger than ever. And, you know, there's even a podcast about the band. So it's like, you know, it sort of makes you angry in some sense to think that, gosh, if Stuart was around today, he would be enjoying all of this so much, you would think.
Well, yeah, I would think so, because it's I think there's a hardcore following there for sure. You know, the band, I think they're off to play in California in a couple of weeks, I think, or early in the new year. They've done a couple of tours of Australia and New Zealand. So the interest is definitely there. There's no question about that.
Without a doubt. Well, tell me a little bit about your record collection, because that interests me. And I know that's going to especially interest Fine, because he's another record collector. So, yeah. I mean, talk a little bit about some of the more rare things that you have, if there's something in particular that you're still interested in. You know, if you're a member of the Big Country Trading Post, so I don't know if you're a member of that site.
No, I'm not aware of that one. I'm writing that down.
Yo, please do. Oh my gosh, that'll be this. You'll be hugely popular there, because it's called the Big Country Trading Post. It's a Facebook site, and it's a place where people, you know, Big Country fans exclusively share rare material and look for rare records and share their finds. So yeah, check that out. Definitely, they would love to hear from you.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've written that down for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
For I've been collecting stuff all around the world, and eBay's been a great way of opening up some of that market. But I've been fortunate enough to work, in the Far East, as well as my daughter lives in the States, so looking around secondhand stores in the States and what have you. I think probably that there's two or three that I've got that I'm most proud of. One is, I've showed some of these to Tony when he came round for the gig, and he'd never seen half of the collection, because unbelievably the record companies would just say, we're going to release this as a single, but they wouldn't even tell them what formats it was being released on or what variants of the album, of the songs would be released. And I found that amazing, to be honest. You know, there's the artist. It's his work. He puts his heart and soul into it, and they don't even bother telling him, oh, well, by the way, there's going to be four copies of this or four versions of this, and these are the formats it's coming out in. He had no idea. So I guess the white sleeve of The Crossing is one that I was chasing probably for about 15 years. I don't know of anybody else that's got a white sleeve of The Crossing, and I'm not even sure this is the one that they sort of mentioned in the discographies that came out in the 80s. It's white, it's just a plain white sleeve, and the logo that's in gold or silver, depending on if you've got the red, green or blue, is actually in green on the front of the sleeve. Now, it's actually produced in Korea, so I don't know if this is a bootleg or whether it is an official release. It has everything and the sound quality on it, on the album. It's a little bit iffy because the vinyl is a bit scratched and what have you, but it does sound like an official release. This is supposedly from Korea. I picked that one up probably about 5 years ago, 6 years ago now.
Wow.
So I'm not sure if there are many other people out there that have got the white sleeve of The Crossing, but that's certainly one that I'm very glad I've managed to track that down. I've never seen it before, never seen it since. So I'm not saying it's unique, but at least it's, yeah.
It sounds very unique. Svein, yeah. Have you ever heard of that one before?
No, I think that is quite a rarity. Okay. Although for those markets, you never know, as you say, is it official or is it semi-official? I think it's recorded as semi-official by most fans, but I'm sure John would look for it if he doesn't have it.
Yeah.
That makes it official.
Okay. I mean, as far as I was concerned, but as soon as I saw it, I knew that was something that I had to add to the collection. The other one, again, is something that I think is unique. I got a box set in a second-hand record store in Notting Hill Gate in London. I only paid £25 for it. And when I got it home and realized exactly what was in there, I was absolutely amazed. It's got three promo copies of The Crossing in the different color sleeves in blue, red and green. It's got the number one and two on the labels.
Wow.
But it also came with all of the 12-inch singles. So, because initially I thought it was the 12-inch single collection, but it went right up to Wonderland. So it had Harvest Home, right up to Wonderland, promo copies of all of them, including the Scotland-shaped Fields of Fire and the red version of In a Big Country. So everything all in a box, and it came with a poster, some stickers, and it was like a record-sized disc of the Big Country logo. In a hard cardboard. So all of that for 25 quid. And I showed it to Tony, and he just had no idea that such a thing existed. I've never seen one advertised since. I've never seen it since.
Oh, man, that's so amazing.
Yeah. So wow. That one I was very happy to get.
And that was the Music and Video Exchange in Notting Hill.
Absolutely. You know it well.
I've been there many times.
Yeah.
But sadly, I missed that box.
Because that's relatively near where I live. So it's maybe 3-4 miles from where I live. So I go there a fair bit. And they do have some really interesting stuff. And they tend to be, pretty reasonably priced for what they're selling. That's for sure.
That is incredible. So that was an officially released box set of some sort then.
Well, I would imagine they would have given it to DJs or something. I can't imagine. It certainly wasn't commercially available, that's for sure, because they were all promo versions.
Right.
Right the way through. But all the singles were the 12-inch versions, and they added in the picture disc as well.
That's amazing. So, what a haul. That must have been an incredible feeling to open that up and find all that stuff.
Yeah. I just thought it was the albums. And I thought that was good enough to get three promo albums for £25. I thought it was a bargain.
Yeah.
But there you go. That's so those two in particular, I think, will probably be the two that I would, if there was a house fire, they're the two I'd salvage, I think.
You mean, don't you save your collection in a fireproof box?
I can't. My collection is just too big. I have a room. For my records. So I've got 400 Big Country records, but my collection goes way back to the doo-wop stuff back in the 50s, right the way through. So I've got, the last count, I've probably got about 9,000 or 10,000 records and CDs.
Oh my goodness. Wow. Wow. Amazing.
I don't smoke. I don't drink. So that's my vice.
It's a good vice to have. You're talking to a person who totally understands you, and Svein. So, Svein's home is covered.
It's a fireproof box.
Yes.
I maybe need to get some tips then, Svein. That's the thing, because that's the thing I have nightmares about,
Yeah, absolutely. That's true. I do a lot of things to secure my own home. But we're kind of close to the neighboring house, and I'm thinking, how careful are these people?
Yeah, exactly.
if something happens there, I'm kind of screwed.
This is it. I would dig a little moat between you and next door. I think that's the way to do it.
I think that's a good idea. That's a great idea. Well, Stuart, you mentioned having Tony over at your house, and that's probably a great segue into this next phase of the discussion. But you had him at your house looking at your record collection, so. Tell us about why he was there and what that experience was like, because he came and played at your home.
He did, yes. So when My Time came out, which incredibly is, a couple of years ago now, or certainly when he came to our house was 2 years ago last week. And the album, unfortunately, was about a 6 month delay in getting the album out. But there was a site at the time called Pledge Music, and very similar to what you did, Thomas, with the WKW, just people were able to pledge a certain amount of money to have different benefits that would come with the album. And I had a landmark birthday just after, or just as the album was released. I was 60. And I said to my wife, if you're struggling to find something for me for my birthday, this would just be awesome. I expected it to sort of be around the time that the album was released, but it was in the November, so it was around 7 months before my birthday. Ian Grant, who was Tony's manager, managed that side of the event for us. And he just said, look, Tony's playing Dingwalls. He's staying with me for a couple of nights. It would be good if we could do the show at your house the night before. It would give Tony an opportunity to play the songs and, maybe an audience of about 10, 12 people. That would be fine. So I had no idea what to expect, whether he'd just come and play for 20 minutes and then leave or whatever. He said, look, Tony will send you an email. He'll tell you what he needs and take it from there. So Tony just said, look, I'd like to start the show at 7 if I could, 7 prompt, because I'd like to get back to Ian's at a reasonable time so we can plan the gig at Dingwalls tomorrow. So I'll get to you at 6:30 and set up. He was there spot on 6:30, set the guitar and might have you up. And the show started at 7, and he played for 2.5 hours. I was absolutely amazed. He just said, look, I want to make this as interactive as possible. So, if you've got any questions you want to ask about Big Country or any of the work that I've done with, Pete Townsend or the Pretenders or whoever else, then feel free just to shout out in between songs. And I'm happy to do a little bit of Q&A in between the songs that I'm singing. And he was absolutely brilliant, I have to say. And, at the end of the show, he said, look, he said, I just didn't expect to get received like this. He said, the reaction was amazing. He said, I know there was only 12 of you, but it sounded like there was, 112. he said, these are the first time I've played these songs to anybody outside of my family. So he said, I had no idea what the reaction was going to be like and whether I was wasting my time or not. And you don't expect somebody who's got that much, I guess, ability and skill to be still a little bit nervous of the reaction that he's going to get to the work that he put out.
Mm.
But I'm hoping that we went some way to calming the fears that he had, before hitting Dingwalls the night after.
Amazing. So what did he play exclusively tracks from his new album? Did he play any Big Country tracks? Did he play any older things from older Tony Butler releases?
He played the whole of the My Time album, and he interspersed that with a couple of Big Country songs.
Okay.
But none of the hits. A couple of tracks off of Why the Long Face, actually. They were the. I've still got the set list. I can share. He asked me to write a review. I'm happy to share the review with you if that's any good.
Oh yeah,
please do.
And then you can see the songs that he sang and the reaction to them. But
incredible.
Yeah. I mean, people say don't meet your heroes. I love Tony's bass playing, always have, and. He was definitely one of my heroes, but he was just so humble, took time with everybody. In the end, I had to say to him, don't sign anything else because you need to go. You've got the gig tomorrow night. he was absolutely a perfect gentleman. There was no question about it.
Wow. So I need to ask you, because if Tony had come to my house, he would have been met with a setup of multiple video cameras and microphones recording everything that happened. Did you take any such precautions? Did you sort of put it down for posterity?
I didn't. No, I've got lots of photos. So I think I sent a photo through of just Tony and myself after. I've got lots of photos during the set. but I didn't record it. I didn't think Ian would let me do that, to be honest.
Right. Yeah. He very well may not have.
Yeah. Yeah. And to, you know, I mean, I know it would have been just for our consumption, as it were.
Right.
But what I did was make sure that everyone that turned up pre-ordered a copy of the album for Tony, you know, from the website. So I think I had about 6 or 7 copies of the album when it was released to give out to the different couples and people that came that night, so they would have a memento of the show.
Oh, that's great. Mm. That's great.
But he invited us to Dingwalls, my wife and I, you know, the following day. So we went for the sound check, and of course Mark was there, and Tony's son as well, who was playing in the band. So that was also, you know, good to see, to be honest.
Yeah. And that was turned out to be his only show, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that. I mean, we have seen some video clips of that.
Okay.
There's some people who shot some video of it, but tell us a little bit about what that experience was like and what his show was like. I know that, he did, I think he did a reggae version of Pink Marshmallow Moon that evening.
He did, yeah. He did Pink Marshmallow Moon acoustically the night before.
Okay, great.
With us. But yeah, he did. He did do a reggae version of that. Again, you know, a great reaction from the crowd. You know, he's such a humble guy, and he won the audience over in a heartbeat. He just said, "Look, you know, I used to be in this other band, and this is one of the songs," as he introduced Pink Marshmallow Moon. But the reaction to the new songs, I thought, was interesting as well. That, you know, you got a really good reaction. And bear in mind, there was no real publicity or hype before that. These were literally, you were hearing the songs from a band perspective for the first time. So no one had anything to sort of say, oh, yeah, that sounds a bit like the album or whatever. Because, as you know, the album was 6 months later before it came out. But no, yeah, very positive reaction. And as you say, I think, you know, given Tony's health scares, then I think it's an absolute shame that he wasn't able to go and promote the album as he would have liked to have done, because I'm sure the tour would have been a great success.
Yeah, without a doubt. That is such a disappointment. Hoping that he will, you know, get back to full health here soon. And I don't know if he would resume that promotion of My Time at this point, or if he would start something else. But certainly an album that was worthy of promoting out there and touring. And it's a shame that was the only one he could do. But
he might tell me off, but I did email him last week when the 2-year anniversary was up, and I asked him how he was doing, and he said he's getting a little bit better, but he's still not there yet. However, he did say he is being creative, but it's very, very early days, and I can't say any more about it. So I didn't push him. I'm hopeful that that means that there might be something else coming out.
That's great. I hope so too. It's always worth hearing new stuff from Tony.
Yeah, definitely.
So tell us a little bit about some of your favorite, you know, big country tracks, and maybe lead that into what big country, just sort of a general, what big country has meant to you over the years, what they continue to mean to you. And if there's one track or one album or one moment that really, I know it's a hard thing to say because there's so many of these moments that it would be a hard question for me to answer. But if there's one track that really stands out to you, that really means the most to you, and one big country memory that really resonates with you the strongest.
So I think there's so many great songs that the band wrote. But I think Wonderland would be my all-time favorite big country song. I'm getting goosebumps now while I'm just saying this to you. I absolutely love that song. I would say between that and Fields of Fire, which was the first song of theirs, as I mentioned earlier, that I heard, it sort of zigzags sometimes between those two as to what my favorite one of their songs are. But to be able to do a top 30 of theirs would be a little bit easier, I think, than just to pick a top one or two. But at the moment, Wonderland is the one that I just absolutely love. But there's some great songs that that the band wrote that never really made it onto an album. And I was always a little bit puzzled by the record company process for selecting songs, because some of the B-sides that the band released are absolutely phenomenal. When a Drum Beats, for example, off the Peace in Our Time sessions, and No Place Like Home had Kiss the Girl Goodbye. And I think those songs are surely those two songs would have been big hit singles in their own rights, but they never even made it onto the album. So I'm not quite sure how that bit works.
Well, you're not the only one. Believe me, we have wondered this with many big country fans for years. Like, how did that song not end up on the album? It's insane.
Yeah, exactly.
I totally understand.
But, I guess they had a time limit for vinyl that maybe CD sort of helped. You push the length of time that you had. So maybe the first two or three albums did sort of suffer till CD sort of caught up, really. What does big country mean to? Yeah, I mean, they still mean a massive amount to me. I'm still collecting. I've just got something on the way from Australia this week. It's a one-sided test press of Steeltown that's coming across to me. I spent £50 on that on eBay, which I thought was money well spent.
Nice.
So it still means a lot to me to collect that. My kids grew up listening to Big Country, so even though they listen to their own music now, when my daughter, I mentioned, lives in the States, she's in North Carolina, and when she goes to see her in-laws in Alabama, the playlist that she plays has Big Country in it, you know, and it's a big country, America, right? So and she sent me a little photo of the display in the car to say, "Dad, thinking of you on the way to the family for Thanksgiving," and all that kind of stuff. So they know how much big country means to me, and it's difficult to sum that up in a couple of sentences, to be honest. They've been a soundtrack really from most of my adult life, Yeah.
I think you summed it up beautifully right there.
Okay. I'm going to try and stop there at that point.
So I guess the final thing that I would ask you is, the band listens to the show usually, quite often. So okay. if you had a message you wanted to give to them, you know, and they're listening to this, what would you say to them, to Bruce, to any of those guys?
Well, I would say thank you, first of all, because I think sometimes when you write a piece of music or art in general, I don't think the artist themselves really understands the impact that it can have on someone's life, a positive effect on someone's life. And certainly Big Country have been such a huge influence. You know, the things that they stand up for politically, you know, definitely resonate with me. My father was born in a steel town, lived in, you know, born and raised in Falkirk, not too far from where Stuart and Bruce were brought up. So all of those songs, Just a Shadow is another one that criminally I didn't mention when you were talking about great songs that the band had written. You know, I looked at Backs That Push the Walls for years and I thank my dad for that one. Yeah, I mean, what they mean to people that I don't think they can ever really fully understand. But thank you, I think, would be my simple message.
That's fantastic. Wow. Well, Stuart, what an absolute pleasure to talk to you. And that was a fascinating discussion. And is there anything that you think that we didn't get to that you wanted to get out there, or anything that we missed?
No, I don't think, to be honest with you, I didn't really have any expectations, you know, other than just to try and answer your questions as succinctly as I possibly could. My wife told me not to waffle. I think she knows how much this stuff goes, and my son the same. Dad, don't waffle. Just get to the point and then move on.
So. Man, I wish our wives had told us that a lot sooner.
I know. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, we went from when we started this show, we would, you know, a 90-minute episode was very, very long for us. And now the typical episode is pushing, you know, 2.5 hours to 3 hours.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, I'm going to catch up with them. I must admit, again, I've come late to the podcast, so I'm working my way through them.
Hey, that's okay. You've got a mountain of stuff that'll last you for a while.
I will catch up, I promise you.
Oh, that's great.
Thanks very much, Thomas.
Thank you, Stuart. It's been great to talk to you.
Privilege. Thanks very much indeed.
Okay, that was Stuart Arnott. Thank you so much, Stuart. That was some interesting conversation. Really loved having Stuart on the show. That was a lot of fun. And despite that great interview, we are not going to be ending the show right now. Sorry, did you get that pun? Stuart Arnott and then we are not. Anyway, I'm sorry. That was terrible. Sorry, Stuart. I apologize to you. I apologize to our entire listening audience. I apologize to the woman who birthed me. Anyway, we are going to continue the show, and we are going to now speak to a fellow American. His name is Tom Stieber, and Tom is going to talk about his Big Country fandom, as well as his experience seeing Big Country in San Francisco back in 1993 for what turned out to be the beginning of the U.S. Buffalo Skinners tour. Some pretty interesting stuff, at a rare free public show that the band did. So, good name. Take it away, Tom. Interviewing Tom. All about Tom. All right, everyone, we're back with a new guest, and this is Tom Stieber. You might recognize him from the Great Divide page or from lots of different things. He's a frequent contributor there, and Tom was a pledger for the WKW campaign. So first off, Tom, thank you so much for pledging for that on behalf of me, Bruce, and Jamie.
It's my pleasure. It's our pleasure, and we appreciate having that opportunity, Tom, you know, because you guys keeping sort of the musical spirit of the band alive with new music is important to all of us. And we're happy to each, you know, do our little tiny part. So thanks for making that available to us.
Oh, that's awesome. Thank you. Really appreciate it. So, you know, we're having you on the show, but we want to have you on the show anyway, because I've known you online for a while. So it's going to be fun to talk with you. Unfortunately,
Unfortunately,
our new Norwegian co-host, who's usually right on time for everything, is not here, because I think he possibly got the times messed up or something, because we were kicking around a few different time options and we finally settled on one, and he might still be thinking we're going to be doing this an hour from now. So we'll see if Svein joins us during the conversation. I have a hunch he will, but for now,
yeah, I mean, my theory is that he's drunk, so we'll see what happens.
That could be too. We'll see. So for now, Tom has been gracious enough to say, let's go on with the show. So it's the two Toms here today. So Tom, I guess the best thing to start with here is, you know, we've been talking with other people who've Pledge and a couple other ones so far, but it's just fun to, and you mentioned this too, it's enjoyable to talk about how people, at least from my perspective, I'm sure from other people's perspectives, how they became fans of the band in the first place, because we all have our own story about it, and you and I both being Americans, those stories might be a little different from someone in the UK. So how did you become a fan of Big Country? When did that happen? And I guess, why did that music resonate with you?
Yeah, that's a great question. It seems like it's a little bit unique for each of us, which I noticed just in terms of different people's comments about favorite songs or things that mean something to them. And I think that's such a fascinating part of it, is that we all came to the band at a different time. We all pick up on different things that, you know, are moving and meaningful to us. So for me, I was pretty late to the party. I sort of don't even remember the In a Big Country video being on very heavy MTV rotation. I kind of vaguely remembered it here and there, but, you know, I was barely like 11 or just turning 11 years old at that time. And at that age, I don't know, I just don't think I had the appreciation for the rousing, anthemic vibe. And I guess given the visuals between, you know, the guys in scuba suits, you know, diving in the frigid Scottish waters with the salmon versus, you know, Duran Duran in their Italian suits, bathing in the Caribbean, you know, that seemed more appealing to my 11-year-old sensibility at the time. So it wasn't until, you know, later on, I sort of vaguely remembered a couple kids in school, like in high school, wearing Seer tour shirts, and they also wore other cool band shirts. So I kind of always thought, oh, I remember that name, but I don't know any of their music, but they like other cool stuff. So it was kind of in the back of my mind. And then it was the summer of 89 when I was hanging out with my friend Catherine at her house, and she was getting ready to go to college. She was a year ahead of me, and I was going through her vinyl, and I was like, "Oh, you've got all these Big Country albums. I've always been curious about them. Can we put one on?" So we just put on The Crossing, and we were talking, and it was very much like background music. You know, we were not listening intently, but it was just sort of on, and I just remember thinking it sounded unlike anything I had really ever heard, but I didn't give it a very thorough listen. But when I left that night, I said, "Hey, this is pretty cool. Could I maybe borrow the other two albums?" And she said, "Sure." So at that point, I took, you know, Steeltown and the Seer home with me, and got out my my 90-minute cassette tapes, and, you know, copied the albums onto tape for the car.
I remember doing that. Yep.
Yeah, and of course the albums were just a little bit too long, so it would cut off the songs at the end, and I don't like songs getting cut off, because I think that just dishonors the song. So I actually sort of faded out the end, you know, a little bit on the last track of each album, which was so sad because it was sort of right when it got climactic.
Exactly. Hey, Tom, I got to stop you for just a second because we have now been joined by Svein. Are you there, Svein?
Greetings and salutations. How are you guys?
Hey. How you doing? Well,
you've sobered up. Thanks for joining us.
Did you forget the time, or were you just late?
No, I was a few minutes late, but that's just because this is such a weird time. So, but I'm here now, so hopefully that will do.
Yeah, no problem. That's great.
Yeah, it's fine. It's really nice to meet you. Are you 6 hours ahead of Tom, or
yeah,
five?
Six
hours?
Ahead of Tom. Yes.
Okay, 9 ahead of me. Great.
Yeah.
Cool.
So Tom, you were talking about making the cassette tapes of Steeltown, The Crossing, and not being able to fit everything in. So
it was actually just Steeltown and the Seer. The Crossing I left behind at my friend's house, so I took those two, took them home. I especially fell in love with Steeltown at that time because it just sounded, you know, unlike anything I'd really ever heard, you know. But in particular, it was really hard to explain, right? Because it's such a unique. It's not just the sound, but there's a certain feeling about the music where, you know, I think we all agree that the band as a whole has always been greater than the sum of its parts, right? Where there's all this individual, like, exceptional musicianship that you can hear. There's so much detail, so many little, counterpoint bass and like little flourishes, like, you know, little mordents and key or time signature changes and all these interesting things that you don't expect usually, you know, in rock music. And to me, in many ways, it felt like rock music with classical music quality. So that was something that was really, intriguing to me at the time. And I think, Stewart's very cryptic lyrics and I think the sort of the heavy emotional quality that he brought to it really tied everything together and made it extremely personal, in a way that I think a lot of music was at that time in the '80s, it was very flashy, and this seemed much more intimate to me. So all those things, kind of that, there was a certain darkness about it, but also this triumphant, joyous nature at the same time. It really felt like the whole gamut of human emotion and aesthetic, everything sort of came together in different ways. And it just felt like incredibly human and personal in a way that I had never really felt before about music. So also at that time, I was getting really, I'd been playing classical piano since the age of 5. So at that time I was working on some pretty complex stuff. I was working on Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, which is a crazy piece. It's got constant key signature and time signature changes. There's crazy syncopations, and sometimes just hearing, the way Big Country brought in some of that, some of those sort of technical, the little technical surprises, I guess, were things that I hadn't heard in a lot of very straightforward top 40 kind of music up to that point. So that really piqued my interest. It just felt like a real like musicians kind of band. And I really felt that, Stewart in particular, he had a very pivotal role, obviously, as the front man and the principal lyricist, and I think the way he conveyed, like I was talking about, that full spectrum of human emotion, sort of from frustration to hope to despair and being very raw, even though it was sort of cryptic, we kind of knew how he felt, even if we didn't always know what he was talking about. That's where I really connected it, that Stewart sort of honestly, openly wearing his heart on his sleeve. And you could really feel that in the music, there was a certain, I think we all sort of agree with, we know that Stewart wasn't the typical rock star persona where he was looking to be admired, but really kind of just wanted to connect with people. And I think sort of that humility allowed the music to shine without the sort of distractions of lead singer stardom that maybe artists like, even Bono aspired to. And maybe even to some extent, I think Mike Peters tried to bring into Big Country when he was on stage, because that's more his personality. Stewart wasn't like that. It was just a real deep and personal humanity that felt profound,
Yeah. Yeah. So, you got into Big Country, really, to be honest, around the same time I did. I was a couple years older, I think, than you. But it, for me, I also missed sort of the crossing because it didn't quite resonate with me yet. And like you, I got into them with Steel Town and then with the Seers. So I'm curious what you think about the way the band changed, I guess you could say, after the Seers. Were they a band? A lot of fans that we talk to, there are a lot of them who really sort of tuned out a little bit after Peace in Our Time came out and the few albums after that, and maybe then came back for Buffalo Skinners. There are some who were there from the beginning and never tuned out, and went along with it. And then there are some who tuned out around that time and never came back. So you've actually obviously come back, but what did you think of the band's changing path, I guess you could say, in their career? And how did you react to those musical changes?
Well, it's interesting because when you come to, the music sort of after the fourth album, in 89, the first four albums were already in. So seeing those, that evolution was, more concurrent than chronological, right? I basically after I heard that, Seer and Steel Town, and just kind of got hooked on that. That's when I started my collecting binge at that time, my early collecting binge. And really I was trying to get my hands on anything and everything that I could at that time. And that included things from all four albums and not always in order, right? So I was listening to things very much out of order to begin with. And I think that's an unusual kind of perspective that maybe something that might grab somebody that's an early fan and then they feel disappointed about the changes, it's sort of all part of one package. And I think maybe when you're listening to those things all at once, you're probably picking up the similarities more than the differences. So to me, they all seem like, you know, different sides of the same coin, right? It didn't feel to me like, well, this is terrible, this is great. I mean, obviously there's songs that we prefer over others, but to me, it all still felt like it was one band. I was still exploring everything. It was still all new. I was super, you know, eager for anything I could get my hands on. And that included, you know, any new releases. So, you know, by the time I went to college and, you know, scoured the record bins, you know, at the stores every week, just in case something came up, you know, and finally, you know, the first single from No Place Like Home comes out and you're looking at this strange, cardboard packaging with this weird, cursive logo. And you're thinking like, what? Is this real? Is this been misfiled? Is this supposed to be in a different section, or am I really, what am I buying here? You know? So I remember buying that and then hearing the Republican Party Reptile track and thinking, I'm still not totally sure that I'm listening to Big Country, even when Stewart started singing, because the vocals were so, you know, growling and the music was so different that it took me till I got to, I think the second track was Freedom Song, and then I was home, and I thought, okay, this is the band I know and love. It's still all here. They're just playing around with some crazy stuff. I was a huge loyalist because it was so new, and I think it was, you know, just it, the honeymoon phase lasted, you know, for quite a while, and that went, you know, I would say those first maybe 6-7 years was maybe my big honeymoon phase, all the way through Why the Long Face. More than anything. So I think that was kind of my big, you know, leap into the deep end.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, you know, we like being in the deep end on this show, so that's good. Totally relate to that. And so you actually, we've talked about the shows that you saw in San Francisco. So let's segue into that a little bit. You actually saw them, on what was sort of like a precursor to the Buffalo Skinners tour.
Right.
And you were saying before we actually went live here or started to record that, and I think you're right, that these were probably the first shows they did in America since the Seer tour. So talk a little bit about these San Francisco shows that you saw that were really connected to the Buffalo Skinners era.
Yeah. I mean, I already, you know, the album hadn't yet been released in the U.S. In September of that year. I had it because I had sort of been, you know, occasionally making a purchase on the country club, you know, mail order. And I had ordered, I don't remember what I'd ordered, but I'd ordered something. And then they, you know, they used to, you know, include like a little sheet of what was happening with the band. And I remember they were saying, you know, the new album was going to be called Buffalo Skinners. The first single was going to be Alone. And that was for the UK and Europe. My family comes from Europe. So my parents were over there all the time. And I had my mom in February of 93 get me the album, as well as the single when she was in Germany. So, so I had heard it, you know, all summer long, and I was really into it. But given that it had been so many months since it had been released, and obviously No Place Like Home wasn't even released in the States, they hadn't toured in so many years. And, you know, Mark Brzezicki still hadn't joined the band. I just thought things were getting smaller and smaller, and you know, they were never ever going to come back to the States. So I just kind of made peace with that. And it was actually at a we were at a street festival, my then boyfriend, now husband, and I were at a street festival in San Francisco, it must have been, I don't know what day of the week September 30th was, which was the day of the show. I think it might have been a Tuesday, so it must have been like a weekend and a half, you know, 2 weekends before, like the 21st. And we're walking around, and suddenly I see a poster on, you know, they used to announce bands all the time on what are those, like electrical posts and things like that, and they'd staple it on.
Oh yeah, I know. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I remember back that in,
yeah. And so I was walking around, and all of a sudden I see like Big Country, you know, on this poster. And I'm like, you know, my stomach dropped. I'm like, what, this can't be happening. I'm speechless. I'm like, you know, look over there. I was like, this, are they kidding me? This cannot be happening. So you know, I go over there. I'm like, you know, forget everything we're doing right now. I said, you know, first thing I did was, you know, steal the poster. There were plenty others around. So I took the poster. Then I went to a phone booth, if you remember those. And I took a quarter, if you remember those. And I called the venue and said, you know, there's this Big Country show on the 30th. Is this like the like Scottish band Big Country? Is this like who's really coming? And they're like, oh yeah, they got a new album coming out. I'm like, oh my God, amazing. Okay. And it was only like 10 bucks, which was crazy. So yeah. And there was, you know, there was really no other promo besides that. I think it was the following week, days before, where there was finally the ad that, you know, in the back of the weeklies, you know, the alternative news weeklies that every big city has here in the States. There's always, you know, I don't know what you guys have in DC, but it's either like, you know,
it used to be like something called the City Paper, I think. And I think that's where I saw the ad for the Buffalo Skinners show that I saw. So, yeah, I get it.
Yeah. And, you know, I was looking in those for years as well, like every week looking at every ad in case, just in case the band might have come, because we didn't have any other way of finding out about stuff. And it was only like that week right before, so it might have been 5 days before the actual show, that it was in that venue's ad, which made it very clear that this was a very last minute thing. There was no advanced planning on this. This was very hurried, very last minute. And then it was sponsored by our local sort of alternative, you know, rock music station, which was called Live 105. And I'd say about 3 days prior to the show, they started doing like heavy commercial promotion for Big Country's return and the free show that they then added during the daytime, this lunchtime concert series they would do. And they had them at Union Square, right in the middle of San Francisco. And, they had this minute-long ad where they would play little clips of, you know, I remember hearing Look Away in a Big Country and Alone were definitely three of the ones they had in the background. And they were talking about the show that night and the free show during the day. So I thought that was cool. They did, you know, a lot of promo for it. I was not sleeping for days, right? I was pretty excited. And I took the train into San Francisco that morning, and my camera with, you know, a roll of 36 photo, you know, film, in those days. And, the anticipation of, you know, walking from the train station over to Union Square and, you know, being, you know, among the very first fans there and just kind of waiting for them to set up was, it was almost surreal, right? Because I never ever thought I was going to see this lineup of musicians that had meant so much to me and had guided me through so many years of my young adult life. And to see them live was just going to be, mind blowing, right? So, the crowd started gathering. It never turned into a very big crowd. It was, you know, very last minute. It was a lunchtime thing. Talked to a few fans that were around. There was a very quirky woman that deserves a show in and of herself. She was a very kooky, nutty lady that she'd basically spent her entire like life savings going to Scotland to visit all of the places, you know, the important places in Stuart Adamson's life. And then she had bought yarn from Scotland and knitted a sweater with the Big Country Starburst logo on it. And she said she was about to lose her job because they wouldn't let her take the day off. So she quit and she didn't know what she was going to do for money. She was out of money. She was heavy, infatuated with Stuart. And when the band sort of slowly was mulling about behind the stage and you could see it because it was all out in the open, you know, her heart sank and she said, oh my God, he's so gorgeous. But I know he's married. I don't want to interfere. You're getting way ahead of yourself, you know? She was a quirky lady and she was at the show that evening too. But eventually, the crew would come out and then I'd see Ian Grant with his, you know, long hair sort of mulling around the back. And then at some point the band comes out and it's like, it's just like a dream, right? It doesn't feel like it's actually happening when you're this American fan that's, you know, been, you know, wanting to see them live for so long. And they come out and, I can't really remember what the order of the set list was. And I didn't grab the set list, but I believe at that time it was very common for them to open with All Go Together. That was kind of their starting set. So I'm pretty sure that's what they started with. And I definitely know they ended with Fields of Fire. Everything in the middle was sort of a blur, although I do remember that between that show and the evening show that they played, five songs from The Crossing, Look Away, Wonderland, and every song from Buffalo Skinners except my two favorites, which were Seven Waves and Selling of America. So I remember the entirety of the set list, just not the order.
And what was the general reaction to that you saw there? Because I remember when I saw the band in DC in October of that year, I didn't know if, you know, I had visions of being one of 10 people there. You know, I didn't know anyone else who liked Big Country, but the place was actually packed and people were really incredibly receptive. So what was your audience like? Were they aware of what Big Country had done? Were they just there out of curiosity? Were they?
That's a good question. So honestly, because of the last minute nature and the sort of, you know, very short notice promo that was done, it did not seem like a particularly knowledgeable or enthusiastic or even large crowd. I thought it was fairly thin. There was maybe, you know, three, you know, sparse rows of, you know, maybe a little bit more enthused fans, or I would say quasi fans, given that I was the only one who, you know, would chant 2, 3, 4 during chants.
Right.
Everyone, who's this guy? What's going on? So there obviously weren't any other like hardcore fans there. And it definitely seemed like it was more like, you know, office workers on their lunch break, kind of hanging out, enjoying the music. And that, you know, that was sad to me, but, I wasn't sure if that was, a sign of the status of the band in the United States at that point completely, or if it was just the reflection of the, you know, the last minute promo that was done. So, the show that night at the club, I also felt was disappointingly sparse considering. I would say it was maybe half full. And again, the crowd didn't seem very knowledgeable or, you know, with the typical, you know, live audience, protocol or etiquette. You know, there's a Big Country etiquette, right? And if you don't know that, I think that you're not that intense of a fan probably. So, I noticed though that in November when they did come back on the full Buffalo Skinners tour, it was a completely different experience, Tom, much like what you had, where the place was completely packed. The crowd was much rowdier. People were, you know, joyfully pushing, shoving, you know, sweating all over each other, you know, dancing around, doing the fan etiquette in the proper way. And it felt like a real Big Country show, you know, whereas these precursors were definitely a little bit sad in terms of like audience, but obviously that didn't take away from the amazing, you know, vibe and feel of and as always, the band always gives it their, you know, everything when they're on stage. They, you know, they don't phone it in, right? They do it full force every time. That it was amazing, you know.
I have to ask you, because I've heard so many stories from people from that precursor, as you call it, to the full tour. When they went around, did PR, they would show up in basically market squares and just play amongst the public here and there to create some interest. And I've heard from so many people that, oh my God, that's Big Country over there almost. Like they didn't hear anything. And then on short notice, they found out that they were there doing something. It sounds like that show you're describing was a little bit like that. So did you know well in advance, and you might have spoken about this earlier before I joined, but how soon in advance did you know when? It seems like from the audience that it was very sudden for most people.
Yeah, exactly. And when I was at the November show, a lot of the people that were there, and there were obviously more, you know, legitimate fans, including, you know, people waiting backstage hours before, you know, like where the exit doors were and stuff. So it was a totally different vibe. And a lot of people said they didn't know about those first shows. And I think that was really it. There's no internet. You know, how are people going to find out about something, you know, 3 to 5 days before it's happening, or even be able to plan around it on a weekday, you know? So I think that was the real problem. But you know, once those shows kind of, those first shows wrapped up, the local radio station really got full force behind the Buffalo Skinners album in a big way, where they were, actually foregoing the official single, The One I Love, in favor of the European single Alone, and we're really playing that on a pretty heavy rotation, at least heavy enough that their little weekly sheet that they would do at put out at Tower Records with all the sort of top 40, like, you know, radio station sponsored album or recommended albums, had Alone somewhere within those top 30 to 40 for, you know, maybe 6 or 7 weeks. and also then featured the Buffalo Skinners on their listening stations, you know, their promoted listening stations at Tower Records. And, you know, I saw as many as, you know, more than 30 copies of the album at each Tower Records location that I visited at that time. So I felt that was a pretty heavy promotion that that at least locally was put behind that album.
Yeah, that's great. That's really great. That's yeah. a great reflection of that time period, definitely. And I had yeah. some similar feelings.
I mean, for those of us who really thought we came too late to the party and we're never going to have those opportunities to see that momentum coming up again and really feeling like you were in the midst of like a renaissance yeah. for the band, especially such a great album that really ranks up there with among the best for all of us.
Exactly.
I think was just an incredible experience that, you know, and then, you know, and then after that, it sort of seemed like it went back to regularly scheduled programming after that. I felt like it was this little treat we got.
Yeah. But, and especially with that time period being no internet yet. It was such a strange time because like you, I didn't even know anything about this show until like a week before it happened. I think somebody saw a small little ad and I was like, what? Big Country is playing here? You got to be kidding. And you know, there was no way to share this with anyone and except for your own circle of friends. And that's right. why I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know anyone else who still liked Big Country. I couldn't yeah. imagine that many people would come see them. And yet I was so happily proven wrong. So, you know, that's kind of a segue into this last question. I think it's probably going to be one of the last ones we can start wrapping up. But this is something that you wrote in an email that you sent to us that I thought was really interesting. And maybe this will be a good thing to sort of note to end on. And you were talking about the line in Fragile Thing that really resonated with you as to, you know, how that reflects on the Big Country fan base. So, I mean, if you want to mention that and talk a little bit about, you know, a little bit more about what you mean by that, because you know, it is really interesting now that Big Country has this huge, at least, you know, to us, it seems huge, this huge internet presence and this huge community. I mean, so many different Big Country pages, a Big Country podcast, you know, and we do feel like there are so many more people out there now who we can commiserate with, who we can relate to, whereas before all this happened we might have felt, you know, lonely in our Big Country fandom. So talk a little bit about that line from Fragile Thing that you mentioned and maybe, you know, about the fan community and what it means to you.
It's something that's always sort of struck me about life, is this idea that when we go through our day and we see, you know, hundreds or thousands of people and we don't really know any of them, but every single one of them has this own full life, you know, and they're the ups and downs and the challenges and this whole rich experience of life, right? And it's no different in the Big Country community. You know, the line I was referring to in Fragile Thing was, you know, there's a low ballet on the highway, brief faces in the light. I catch them for a second, heading somewhere in the night, and we have no connection but the darkness and the road. I better find a place tonight. I better call it home. And it just, I think that's such a, you know, I was so glad to see that Stuart experienced that too, because, you know, we're in this huge big world. We're all connected through this, you know, internet, you know, online presence, and we're in these groups, but we really don't know anything, you know, much about each other. And there's a way for us to connect, but we're still very disconnected. And there's, I think having an opportunity just to have a conversation with you guys about Big Country, which I haven't been able to do in 25 years because, you know, nobody will listen. Just, you know, personalizing things like that and getting to know a few of each other, you know, one at a time, you know, is I think it's just that human connection that we all cherish. And I think that Stuart very much felt the same way too, where, you know, it's clear in the music that he felt very sort of alone in the world, and a lot of his lyrics reflect that. And at the same time, just always looking for that connection to other human beings. And for him, the music was his way of expressing himself to all of us. And that's the way that we can maybe relate to him and the band on a personal level. And then as a greater Big Country community to each other, I think it's great just to get to know each other a little bit more, especially those of us who are so far away here on the Pacific Coast and so far from the action. You know, some people can meet up at concerts and stuff. We don't really have those luxuries as much. And it's nice to be able to bring a little bit of one-on-one personal humanity to everything.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. And yeah. So are you going to be going to any of the West Coast shows that we've heard about recently?
Unfortunately, I won't be able to because my husband is a cystic fibrosis patient. Oh. And that means that this is the time of year neither of us goes to crowded places because of the colds and flus. They're very dangerous for him to pick up. So we kind of hibernate a little bit for the next few months. As we get into summer, I hope they might come back. On the Journey Tour, my husband had actually picked up the flu that spring, and it took him about 7 months of recovery. And the night that I was able to see the band on the Journey Tour was really the only night I was able to really get away from taking care of him during that several month period. And I had some family members kind of take care of him at that time. And that was made it especially meaningful for me to get away. But right now, you know, everyone's healthy and wanting to keep it that way. So I hope they come back. Otherwise I would have certainly been up in LA and done that, but what can you do?
Yeah, definitely. Well, gosh, I'm sorry to hear that, but I'm glad he's doing well now. And yeah, health has to come first, obviously. So good for you. Hopefully they will get back. I know that they are, you know, testing the waters in a sense too. So there's a good chance I think they'll be back and you get another shot at it.
I think so. And if it's, especially if they're, you know, summertime shows and Southern California is a big place, hopefully we can, go to multiple shows. I was only able to go to that one, in 2013, but, you know, there were three or four Southern California shows, and I certainly would want to travel and get to connect with, like we're talking about, meeting some other fans and being part of the Big Country family, like one-on-one, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, that's awesome, Tom. And is there anything that you know, you want to say that we didn't get to, or that, you know, we didn't prod you in the correct direction. So anything that you missed that you want to get out there?
No, not at all. You know, I think it's, I'm so appreciative of what you guys do, with the podcast as part of the bigger global Big Country community. You guys are kind of like our, Statler and Waldorf from the Muppets, right?
That's right.
And you know, between you guys and a few of the other groups, it's such a great way to connect. But I really do hope that, besides the stories, that it's good to learn a little bit about each other and put the faces to the names and become, you know, individuals to each other, I think is a nice thing. And I think if any community can bring that about, you know, connecting in that way, it's got to be the Big Country community.
Exactly. I don't know if you listened yet to the last episode we did about my Liverpool trip. You heard many examples of just that, just going there and meeting all these people for the first time. And it's so unique. And everybody has similar stories. So that's awesome.
That's amazing. I know. I love that. So, thank you guys. I appreciate the opportunity to be on the show. You know, and I had bought my way onto the show. So technically you had me, but
hey,
you know,
it was our pleasure. And, you know, bought your way onto it or not, I always find it fascinating to talk with other people that I have never talked to before, but have seen, you know, so many times and communicated with. And I have to say too, that I wanted to thank you because, you were helpful to me early on in the whole WKW thing as a sounding board. I shared a couple of those things with you early and you gave some good feedback. And, I was sort of just picked a couple people, just thought, I'll send a song to him or to her and see what they think. Just do a little market research. So
my nosiness and probing, you know, paid off on my end. I really appreciated having a little bit of an inside, a preview of everything.
Yeah. And that was great.
And I'm very, envious of so many. There's so much. I'm so in awe of all the musical talent and, all that we see so pervasively in the Big Country community. So many people, you know, in making music and singing the songs and joining together, and even all these new cover bands that are coming together and doing shows in UK. I think that's such a wonderful thing that we can all share in that. I'm more of a pianist. I don't think the piano lends itself well to Big Country music, which is kind of sad for me. I just think it doesn't translate as well as I would like. So, trying to pick up a little bit of the guitar. It's very hard, you know, at this stage in life. We were very busy people.
I know.
Hard to kind of sink our teeth in. And I don't have any, you know, big expectations. I just want to make a little music in a new way. And, you know, I don't know if you guys know if there are ways that people can actually virtually connect, you know, online in ways where they can, you know, make music together across the world. Are there things like that? Because I would be so like eager to join up with people and do some little things like that. There's got to be other people that want to make music together that aren't that are thousands of miles apart.
Yeah,
you have it.
Yeah, I mean, you putting this out there, I think will help maybe find you some people. But I know people have done that before. I know I've seen that before where people have, you know, someone has played drums in the UK, someone has sang in the US, and someone has played guitar in Scotland. And
yeah, and we even featured one of those songs on a podcast approximately near episode 40 or so.
Oh, we did.
Yeah, wow. We did.
See, I'm not sure of the exact episode, which is unlike me, but it's a while back. Okay. We definitely featured one of those. So yeah, it happens.
Yeah.
Let's put that out there, you know, and the more low tech, the better, because, you know, as you start getting more complex and, you know, sharing files and having to someone has to edit everything, that makes it much more complicated. If there are sort of collaboration apps that can be easily, you know, used by low tech kind of people, I think that would be great, because, you know, I understand, you know, music is very highly technical, but I'm not a tech guy. I just want to play from the heart, make some music and just get it from the inside to the outside. And that's really it. So, let's see what people might be able to bring to the table
So anybody listening to this, you know, if you have an interest in making some music too, like Tom here, let us know on the page and we'll connect you guys. So
that would be amazing. Yeah. Well, thank you. I think it's been so nice talking to you guys and
you too, Tom.
Just having a conversation about something that means so much to me, and hopefully, we will no longer have to say, "You don't know me. You've never seen me before." Now we know each other a little bit.
Very, very nice. Restless Natives pool. I like that. No, that's great. Okay. And absolute pleasure to have you on. And thank you so much. And best to you and your husband. And, hopefully you guys get a chance to see the band again at some point in the future. And we really appreciate all the stories. And again, I really appreciate the support of the WKW stuff. So thank you again for that.
Yeah, I'm so eager to get take a listen. I haven't had a chance yet. And I'm probably going to burn some CDs today with those files and put it in the car. So we'll probably drive today. So
that's awesome. That's awesome.
All right. We'll talk to you guys soon. All right, have a great rest of your day.
Great to speak. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, so that's episode 88 in the books. Another inch closer to episode 100. What does that mean? I don't know, but it would be cool to have an episode 100 at some point. Didn't think we'd ever get there, but man, we're close enough now that we've got to keep moving toward it. Anyway, I hope you guys enjoyed that. We really enjoyed having Stuart and Tom on the show. We've got, as I say, we've got four more pledgers to interview in upcoming shows, and it should be fun. So the next show will probably be a similar format. These shorter shows are maybe not what's expected of us at this point, but it's kind of a nice change of pace for us after all the lengthy, insane deep dives that have just gotten bigger and bigger. So anyway, I hope you enjoy this. Thank you so much, Stuart. Thank you so much, Tom. And thank you so much, as always, Spine and JF&G. You can send us an email if you'd like to speak with us or get in touch with us at bigcountrypodcast@gmail.com. If you'd like to learn more about WKW or purchase the CD or purchase the digital version of the album, we also have demos and instrumentals and some other cool stuff. You can visit wkwmusic.com and purchase it, or even just listen to it before you purchase it, or purchase it before you listen to it. That's typically the way I would prefer. So anyway, thank you very much. We will be back probably sooner rather than later. Hope everybody has had a great start to 2020, and we will talk to you very soon. Take care.
How long have you guys been talking?